Our next speaker has dealt extensively with the often contentious relationship between religion and the law. Andrew Seidel, of our own Madison, Wisconsin, received his Master's of Law from Denver University with a perfect GPA and has been the recipient of numerous accolades for his writings regarding religion and its place in our nation's legal history. He now works as a constitutional consultant for the Freedom From Religion Foundation, taking on the important work of making sure that the Establishment Clause of our Constitution is upheld and ensuring that citizens of the United States are still able to enjoy their rights to a secular government. Please join me in welcoming our next speaker, Andrew Seidel.
Can everybody hear me okay? Okay. So first, I'd like to thank Chris and the students for putting this on. This is fantastic. There's a lot of people here today. Everybody, yeah, give them a round of applause. You know, for me, it's an honor to share the stage with a lot of these people. And there's one more person I need to thank, my beautiful wife, Liz. When I was offered a job with FFRF, she made a big sacrifice in her career so I could chase this dream of fighting theocracy. So thank you, honey. So in the 2008 election, John McCain made the statement that our Constitution founded us as a Christian nation. He caught a lot of flack for that. So he backtracked and said, well, actually, we're founded on the values of Judeo-Christian values, whatever that means. All right? This argument, the second argument, that we're founded on Judeo-Christian principles, goes unchallenged too often. And that's what I hope to change here today. I hope to give you guys the ammunition that when people backtrack off the Christian nation and say we're founded on Judeo-Christian principles, you can say something back to them. Now, typically, you're going to hear, I'm not arguing that we're not influenced by Christianity or Judaism in our culture and our society, just that our laws and our constitution and our system of government was not influenced by them, at least not in a positive way. Mm-hmm. And these are the three things that you typically hear for the Christian nation. Well, we're one nation under God, or in God we trust, or the Declaration of Independence established us as a Christian nation. One of the other speakers mentioned that earlier today. And finally, that the founding fathers were all Christian, and so we're a Christian nation. So let's take this each in turn. Two things to notice about one nation under God and in God we trust is the timing of when they were added into our vernacular and the effect. So in God we trust was added to the coins in 1863 and to our paper money in 1956. All right, one nation under God added to the pledge in 1954. So these are times when civil rights are rolled back, people are fearful, and the nation is in a lot of, it's a national crisis, essentially. So 1863, you have the Civil War. All right. Battle of Gettysburg was fought that year. Lincoln has declared martial law. He suspended habeas corpus for the first time. The only other person to do that was W after 9/11. Right. And enter Salmon Chase. He was the Secretary of the Treasury, and he wrote to James Pollock, the Director of the Mint, and he said, this whole thing was in a letter, but the important part to pay attention to is the time for the introduction of this or a similar motto, that we're a Christian nation, is propitious. The nation is literally tearing itself apart. Brothers are killing brothers. And the time is propitious to add God to our coins. Right? Second one, you guys are all probably familiar with McCarthy. So witch hunts, I mean, the height of McCarthyism was 1954 and 1956, right? You have the fear of communism running rampant. There's blacklists, there's hunts for spies, people are getting arrested. This is some of the propaganda. And then you have McCarthy and Billy Graham in a fight to Christianize our nation. Let's go back there. So Senator McCarthy said that. The final all-out battle between light and darkness foretold in the Bible. That's the time that it was. That's the time that they chose to inject Christianity onto our money and the Pledge of Allegiance. And you have Billy Graham. He said a lot more than that. He was out of the moment. The point to pay attention to is that religion is divisive, and they were using these times of national strife to turn the nation that was created for everyone into a nation that was created for Christians. James Madison said this, religion is divisive, it should not be a controversial statement. The founders were well aware of this, that's why they gave us the First Amendment. And what these people did was they took unifying themes, the founders came up with this as our national motto, E Pluribus Unum, of many one, of many states, one nation, of many people, one nation. Instead, they erased that with this divisive theme that we're one nation under God, that only a few of us, nobody in this room probably, is included in that. And for the pledge, it's even worse. One nation indivisible. Again, a unifying theme. And they literally divided that with God. I know, it's kind of funny, but it's kind of sad too, right? Okay. So again, I don't think these show that we're a Christian nation. I think they show that a lot of people are willing to use the politics of fear in times of national crisis to capitalize and push their beliefs on others. So let's move on and we'll talk about the Declaration of Independence. There's four references in the Declaration of Independence that people typically use to support the idea that we're a Christian nation. And these are them. The laws of nature and nature's God, their creator, the supreme judge of the world, and divine providence. Not a single one of those is Christian. Nobody mentions Jesus or Christ or Yahweh or the God of Abraham, right? And the men who drafted this, they were careful men. So Thomas Jefferson wrote the rough draft, and then John Adams and Ben Franklin got together, and the three of them hammered out the rough draft, or the final draft, excuse me. They chose each word carefully. They could have referenced a Christian God if they wanted to. They didn't. And we actually have the rough draft of the Declaration. You can see they changed the word. They added in self-evident. I mean, these were careful men. They chose each word with great care. And not a single reference to Judeo-Christianity in there. The one that I want to talk about the most, the laws of nature. I can do this. I could do all of these in detail. I don't have the time. So I'm just going to talk about the law of nature and nature's God because that actually mentions God, and people like to focus on that one. This is talking about natural law. This is, of these four references, Jefferson only put the first one in. The other three were added in later. And the laws of nature and nature's God is talking about natural law. And there are, there are two ideas for natural law, that rights are rights are given to us by God, or that we have rights simply because we are human. Anybody want to take a guess which one Jefferson was a fan of? We actually have his writings, and he tells us. Questions of natural right are triable by their conformity with moral sense and reason of man. They're not God-given. We have those rights because we are human. He goes, and here's another one. A free people claiming their rights as derived from the laws of nature. Again, not given by anybody. We have them because we are human. You have to go out and claim those rights. Okay? Now, the other three references that I mentioned, they were added in by Adams and Franklin. And it's important to know why these were added in. So the Declaration of Independence was written by these three guys to convince, first of all, the world of the separation, our separation from England, and second of all, this guy, King George III. But King George was a very pious man. He was the head of the church, and he actually declared himself a Christian hero, whatever that means. All right. Now, if you're writing to somebody who's that pious, and you know they're that pious, these men definitely knew it, what are you going to do? Of course you're going to throw some things at him. I mean, if you only answer to God, then you if that's what you think anyway, of course the founders are going to argue that God is on our side. But you know, Franklin, when he was our ambassador to France during the Revolutionary War, used to wear a coonskin cap around to play the rustic American. He wore everywhere, I think except in his audience with the king, he had the hat on the entire time. And if he is willing to do that, I call him a pragmatic persuader. If he's willing to do that, I think he'd be willing to add in a few, kind of fuzzy deistic fuzzy deistic divine providence type of language. Okay? But the more important thing for the Declaration of Independence is that it embodies two ideas that are fundamentally opposed to Christianity. And those ideas are, number one, that we have a right and a duty to throw off our government when it becomes tyrannical. And second, that governments come from men and women. I mean, we give the government its power, not God. And those ideas So this is some of the language. It's necessary. It's a necessity. It's a necessity. It's a right and a duty to throw off that government. And governments derive their powers from the consent of the governed. Those ideas are fundamentally opposed in the Bible. You've probably seen this quote, Romans. No authority except which God has established exists. Right? So all governments come from God. God gives them power. Here's another one. The Most High has sovereignty over the kingdom of mortals and gives it to whom he will. So again, if God creates government and gives governments power, you can't rebel against that, because to rebel against it would be to rebel against God. If the founders followed biblical ideals, we would still be an English colony. Right? So we should all be thankful that they didn't. So this is my favorite one that you hear about. I mean, the faith of the founding fathers, the argument over whether or not they're Christian or deist has been going on since their time. George Washington died in 1799, and in 1800, Parson Weems, an ordained minister, published this book. You've probably heard stories from this book, even if you don't recognize it. The idea that George Washington chopped down a cherry tree but couldn't tell a lie about it, that comes from this book. The idea that George Washington prayed in the snow at Valley Forge comes from this book. Not true, by the way. No evidence to support that whatsoever. So the fight has been going on for a long time. And I'm going to suggest to you that, first of all, this is rude, because it is demonstrable that some of these founders were not Christians. Some of them were, at best, deists. And to claim that the nation is Christian just because some of them were, I think, is incredibly arrogant of the Christians. And second of all, to attribute to God the monumental sacrifice of this generation, I mean, it denigrates that sacrifice to give it to God and not to them. Right? But I also think that the faith of the founders doesn't really matter. Because whatever they personally believed, they chose to do something different. I mean, religious ideas don't give ownership over all the other ideas that are generated by that mind. You know, we don't have Jewish blue jeans. There's just blue jeans. We don't have Jewish vaccines. There's just vaccines. And there's no such thing as Muslim math, even though algebra is not an English word. Right? And the point is, whatever they privately believed, publicly, they chose to erect a wall of separation between church and state. They chose to give us the First Amendment. They wanted government out of religion and religion out of government. So no matter what they personally believed, it doesn't make us a Christian nation. Now, I'm going to move on a little bit to the Judeo-Christian principles. When I set out to debunk the Judeo-Christian principles, I had to figure out what they were. It turns out that when people make the statement that we're founded on Judeo-Christian principles, nobody bothers to back that up and say, well, this is specifically what I'm talking about. The best I could find was Harry Truman once said, and he was president during the beginning of McCarthy's reign of terror there, that Judeo-Christian principles are from the Ten Commandments and from the Bible. So I decided to look closely at the Ten Commandments and compare them to our Constitution and our Bill of Rights, and then look at some of the major principles in the Bible and do the same. It turns out they conflict in most all cases. So first, let's check out the Ten Commandments.
All pay heed! The Lord Jehovah, has given unto you these 15... Ten commandments.
You gotta love Mel Brooks. But he actually brings up an interesting point here. How many commandments were there? By my count, yeah, there's a lot. By my count, there's actually 40, at least. There's four sets of Ten Commandments in any given Bible. These are their citations, if anyone wants to go check them out. So which 10 is probably the best question you can ask somebody when they say, well, we are founded on the Ten Commandments. Go back and say, which 10? I mean, most of these people don't realize that. Actually, Justice Scalia wrote a little footnote about this in one of the cases and said he had no idea about this either. And then he went on to say, so it doesn't matter and it's irrelevant, which, anyway. So the first set, Moses gets on the mountain. He comes down from the mountain and he finds his followers worshiping a golden idol. They're breaking the second commandment, which, by the way, they don't know about. So Moses smashes the commandments and then murders 3,000 of his followers. God says, I'll give you a second set of commandments. Moses creates tablets. God gives him the second set. And then God says, and I'll wipe out everybody off the land that I'm going to give to you. So he promises genocide while giving those second set of 10 commandments. And he lays claim to the firstborn of Israel. And then he goes on to say, don't boil a kid in your mother in its mother's milk. And that's this type of kid, not the other kind of kid, for those of you who don't know. The third set of 10 commandments is substantially similar to the first set. And the fourth set is just a list of people who are cursed. And I'm going to now, well, we'll go on here. In addition to the intra-biblical differences, there's inter-religious differences. Okay? And then obviously there's different translations of the Bible. Thou shalt not kill versus thou shalt not murder is actually a big difference. Then you have the different religious traditions. They actually number them differently. And some people may think, well, that's not that big a deal. But I think there is no such thing as a small religious difference. When you couple absolute certainty with these beliefs, I don't think that there can be any such thing as a small difference. So there was an 18th century Russian group that should have translated their holy book this way, that Jesus Christ was the Redeemer, and he told them to go out and be fruitful. They translated it this way. Yeah. So you can figure out religious certainty coupled with this mistranslation makes a big deal. It's a small mistranslation, but it's got a big effect. Okay, no small religious differences. I'm going to focus on the Protestant Ten Commandments and the first set in the Bible, even though that's not actually referred to as the Ten Commandments. That's one everybody knows because of Charlton Heston. So the first commandment, I am the Lord thy God. The Ten Commandments are superior. Right? This is in conflict with our Constitution. The Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and where does the Constitution come from? We the people. So again, there's a fundamental conflict here. Right? And obviously, this would also conflict with the First Amendment. You can have as many gods as you want in this country, and as many before him as you choose. Second commandment, shall not make an idol. Obviously, that conflicts with the First Commandment. You can make as many idols as you want, say anything you want. The interesting thing about this one is that nobody ever talks about the final part there, punishing children for the inequity of the parents unto the third and fourth generation. So great-grandchildren, grandchildren get punished. Again, I think this is fundamentally at odds with our system of justice. And actually, in the Constitution, it says, no attainder of treason shall work a corruption of blood. And what that means is if you're found guilty of treason, only you will be punished, not your children. And that was actually a big problem prior to the United States putting that in the Constitution. Not in our country, but in England. So again, fundamentally opposed, and our system of government and our justice system is based on the presumption of innocence, and we don't punish children for their grandparents' mistakes. Right? Don't take the Lord thy God in vain. I don't really know what this means. Does anybody have a good answer for me for what this means? Telling God what to do? I've heard telling God what to do. I've also heard you can't curse, so saying like, God damn, would be taking his name in vain. And also, I've heard taking oaths. Using God's name in vain, which a lot of people do in this country all the time. So I would argue, first of all, that this is against due process because nobody knows what it means. For those of you who are lawyers out there, it's void for vagueness. You want to look that up. Obviously, it also goes against free speech. It goes against the First Amendment. So the first three commandments are directly in conflict with the First Amendment. Now, the fourth commandment is remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Because the Lord made heaven and earth in 6 days, and on the seventh day he rested. So first of all, if God is all-powerful, if he's omnipotent, why did it take him 6 days, and why did he need to rest? And why are we celebrating that? All right. Now, we do have to concede something here, because There are some Sunday closing laws in this country that have been around for a long time. But we have to concede it with the caveat that the Sabbath is not necessarily Sunday. And the Jews celebrate the Sabbath on Saturday. So, I mean, and it's their Ten Commandments, really. And the Supreme Court has said that you can't uphold a Sunday closing law on religious grounds. It has to be on secular grounds. Okay? So it's a little influence, nothing I think that is earth-shattering, but there is some more influence, and that is slavery. So slavery is implicitly recognized in this commandment, and we can concede to the Christians that this had an effect on our foundations and our laws. I mean, every justification for slavery was biblical at the beginning of our country. So they can have it. Fifth commandment, honor your mother and father. I haven't been able to figure out how this could possibly influence our laws. We're just going to move on. So I grouped these together. Don't kill, don't steal, and don't bear false witness against your neighbor. First of all, these are not Judeo-Christian. These are the fallback for everybody. When they say our country is based on the Ten Commandments, and you ask them, what ones? They immediately go to don't kill, don't steal, don't lie. But these, again, are not Judeo-Christian principles. These are principles that every successful society and culture in the history of the world has come up with on their own. And to call them Judeo-Christian, I think, is the height of arrogance, and probably a little bit of ignorance with history as well. So first of all, they're not Judeo-Christian. And second of all, these aren't as moral as they appear. And I want to talk to Richard about this afterwards. But I think they only apply to your neighbor. So you could read those commandments. The original Hebrew doesn't have punctuation marks, line breaks. It's really difficult to read. All that stuff was added in later by later editors. So you could read those commandments. Don't kill your neighbor. Don't steal from your neighbor. Don't commit adultery with your neighbor. Don't lie to your neighbor. So everything would apply to your neighbor. So then the question is, who's your neighbor? And Leviticus gives you some indication here. Your neighbor is your people. Your people are your neighbor. The children of thy people are your neighbor, and the sons of your people are your neighbor, and your countrymen are your neighbor. So in other words, this is in-group morality. This is only applying to your fellow believers, not everybody else. And this makes sense with the rest of the Bible. Because after they get the Ten Commandments, God orders them to slaughter hundreds of people. These are all the genocides that I've found in the Bible. Not all of them, just some of them. So God tells them, don't kill. And then God tells them in the next book to go out and slaughter thousands and thousands of people. But none of those people are Israelites. They're all other tribes. So for the Bible to make sense and be internally consistent, I think neighbor has to mean only other Israelites. So this is not as moral as the universal principles that our law is based on either. Okay, you shall not commit adultery. I think we can't argue that Christianity has influenced the legislation of sex in this country. We have a terrible history. This is the Lovings, if anybody's familiar with Loving versus Virginia. We essentially outlawed being gay in this country. We outlawed interracial marriages. And this is just two of the many ways that Christianity has influenced sex legislation in this country. But in Loving versus Virginia, that case overturned interracial marriage. And the statute was based on the fact that the Almighty God created the races and put them on the different continents so that they couldn't mix. So anti-miscegenation was based on Christian ideas. The anti-sodomy statutes, this is a Supreme Court case, 1986 too. Condemnation of sodomy, of being gay, is firmly rooted in Judeo-Christian moral and ethical standards. That's an accurate statement, and it has influenced our law, but it's done so in hateful and bigoted ways. Again, they can have them. This was the dissent in that 1986 case, and that 1986 case was overturned in 2003 for anybody that's worried that that's still on the books. So don't covet your neighbor's house or your neighbor's wife or anything that belongs to your neighbor, including slaves. Again, I think this conflicts, aside from the admission of slavery and the subjugation of women and treating them as property, which probably did influence our laws a little bit, I think this is fundamentally in conflict with our First Amendment. We do not have thought crime in this country. You know, a typical rebuttal that I get to this is, well, we have hate crime legislation. That's not the same thing. Hate crime legislation doesn't punish you for thinking something. It punishes you for acting on something because of what you thought. So, for instance, if you beat somebody up because they're gay, you're being punished for beating them up. Right? But we in this country, we always take into account what's going on in the mind of a criminal. I mean, all the different variations of murder, first degree, second degree, involuntary, voluntary, that depends on what the person was thinking at the time they committed those acts. So it comes into play, but you're only punished for the act, not for the thought alone. And the Supreme Court has actually said that thoughts cannot be punished on their own. So the Ten Commandments had some influence on our laws. 4 and 7, shameful, hateful, bigoted ways. But most of them are in conflict with the Constitution, with the Bill of Rights, and everything that we hold and value, everything that we value in our foundations. Okay? And then, obviously, the other ones are universal. FFRF sells those stickers if you want to. So moving on from the Ten Commandments to some general principles in the Bible itself. Obedience is rife in the Bible. Obey, 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 be a servant to God, be a slave to God. Okay? If you don't obey God, you get turned into a pillar of salt. For peeking, don't turn around and look back, and she looks back and he turns her into a pillar of salt. And then there's the story of Isaac and Abraham. The attempted murder of his own son is held up as this great act because he was obeying God. He was so fearful of God that he was willing to kill his own son to obey God. So obedience is a fundamentally Judeo-Christian principle. And I think that it is completely opposed with our foundations. Yeah. Edmund Burke, English statesman, in 1775, he gave a speech advocating reconciliation with the colonies. And this is what he said. A love of freedom is the predominating feature which marks and distinguishes the character of the Americans. The fierce spirit of liberty is stronger in the English colonies probably than in any other people on earth. You know, one of the purposes of our Constitution is to secure the blessings of liberty. We are about liberty and freedom. I think if you asked almost any American, including a lot of the people who believe in this stuff, that they would say the fundamental American value is freedom. And again, I think they are totally at odds and can't be reconciled. Hell is another Judeo-Christian principle, and more properly, it's a Christian principle because it was invented by Jesus. The Jews had a place called Sheol, kind of an afterlife, but no torture. Both good and bad people went there. And here's how hell is described. A burning wind, a fiery oven, judgment by fire, unquenchable fire, furnace of fire, eternal punishment, where the worm dieth not and the fire is not quenched. Okay? You get the sense that it's hot there. You get the sense that it's forever. Okay? I think that this is in conflict with the Eighth Amendment. I don't know if you can see what's going on in this picture, but that looks cruel and unusual to me. The Supreme Court actually held that being stuck in a jail cell with a 5-pack-a-day smoker is cruel and unusual punishment. So being stuck in a jail cell with a 5-pack-a-day smoker is cruel and unusual. Being burned eternally has got to be cruel and unusual. So again, a fundamental principle at odds with one of our fundamental principles. Golden rule, not Judeo-Christian. I think everybody should know this by now. It's predated. I mean, here's Jesus down here with his golden rule. There's Hillel, number 12. So, I mean, you can see the golden rule or formulations thereof, universal, again. So just like the 6th, 7th, 9th commandments, this is not something that's unique to Judeo-Christianity. But this is the most important one, I think. So if there's one Christian principle, it is that Jesus died for your sins, and that you are vicariously redeemed through his sacrifice. Okay? This is a complete abrogation of personal responsibility. Our system of laws and our government is founded on the idea of personal responsibility. I mean, our criminal justice system would absolutely collapse if people could say, let's say they get on the stand and the defendant admits that he raped that child. It's okay, judge. I have accepted Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior. Oh, you don't have to go to jail then. You're not responsible for your acts. And that system of justice only works for these guys. It's not. It's fundamentally opposed to our country. All right, now, I got to stop in a minute here. There are plenty more of these conflicts, the immutability of God's law versus the amendability of our Constitution, the idea of original sin versus the presumption of innocence. And these, they don't reconcile. They don't go together. Before I conclude, I'm going to share this quote. This is my favorite quote from the founding generation for now. This is James Madison. And in it, he tells us that we have a duty to take alarm at the first experiment in our liberties. Okay? Each and every one of you has a duty. Now, I just read a study that said 18 to 30-year-olds in this country, 25% of you are non-religious now. That's fantastic, and that number is climbing. And the future of this movement depends on you. I'm going to say to you that it's not enough to like things on Facebook or to debate people in comments online. It's fun, but it's not enough. You've got to get involved. I mean, JT had some great advice earlier. Hemet had some great advice. You've got to get involved. It's your duty as citizens. Now, oops. Oh well, we'll leave it off. FFRF was started by Annie Laurie Gaylor. Three people were challenging government prayer on their own. They were tired of hearing government prayer. They wanted to stop locally. Now we're 18,000 members. Right? It's up to you guys. You've got to join up. You've got to do something. In 1964, I think it was. Let me double check that. I want to get it right. 1964, Kitty Genovese was murdered while 38 people watched. Nobody did anything. Everybody else thought that somebody else would take care of it. Somebody else would call the cops. It is up to you. Each and every one of you, you have to challenge these ridiculous ideas that we're a Christian nation. Each one of them is an erosion of the Jeffersonian wall of separation of state and church. You've got to get out there and challenge them. Thank you. Answer questions later, and we're doing a panel this afternoon, Annie Laurie, Sean Faircloth, Ellery Shemp, and I, so I'll answer any questions then, or anytime you see me, I'm happy to.